You know, what we've been doing with Hebrews, again, if you've been in all the class, not in any way a full study of the book. It's been primarily an overview, trying to emphasize some of the major points of the book. And I hope it's piqued your interest and it's made you, you know, study. And even after each class, you go, I wish we could have talked more about such and such that you've noticed in this book. It's a wonderful book to really deepen our appreciation for what we have in Jesus. And that's the point of the book. We're going to talk tonight in question one, and we're going to be on lesson seven, about the end of the old law, the bringing in of the new covenant. And we can think about, and we're going to talk about, so many doctrinal applications that has. But the real focus of the book, the number one theme is, don't lose Jesus. Don't turn from Him. Because you turn away from Jesus, you've turned away from everything that really matters. That's where all hope is found, all the blessings. Now, in this question number one about the new covenant, the New Testament, we do want to look at this, and it's an important point. I think we often, and we're going to talk about specifically instrumental music, things to do with the Sabbath, we often have to deal with the new versus the old. You know, whereas the primary thrust to those first century readers, it had that application, but it was even more about the better. The superiority was, you know, the point he's trying to drive home. But what Old Testament prophet had foretold the making of the new covenant? Jeremiah. What chapter in Jeremiah? Jeremiah 31. And Jeremiah lived what time period in the Old Testament? Judah alone, overlapping with the captivity. You know, he was the man on the ground in Judah as all three captive groups were taken away. He began to prophesy about 626 B.C. And then in 605, when Daniel was taken into captivity, there was Jeremiah still prophesying in Judah. 597, when Ezekiel would go away into captivity in a large group, there was Jeremiah still preaching in Judah. In 586, when the temple is destroyed and the large group is taken again, there's Jeremiah preaching. And then, of course, finally, he was forced to move to Egypt with the remnant. But he was on the ground all that time. And think about, it's about 600 B.C., 600 years before Christ, God, through Jeremiah, says, there will be a new covenant made. It will not be like the covenant I made when I brought them out of Egypt. There will be a new covenant. You know, that's one of those things I think maybe we look at and we say, how did they miss that? You know, that there was just such a controversy, difficulty in the first century about circumcision, about the various meats and the laws. And we go, how did they not see it coming? And that's part of what the Hebrew writer says. You should have seen it coming, guys. What do you think Jeremiah was trying to say? And then, as he begins to develop this, though, when did he say Jesus became the mediator of the new covenant? When did he actually, the covenant, come into effect? At death. Chapter 8 says the new covenant and gives us some things about it. Chapter 9, you know, tells us so plainly, he is, verse 15, the mediator of the new covenant by means of death. Verse 16, for where there is a testament, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. The writer really makes, we might call it a play on words. The word for covenant and the word for testament are the same Greek word. You know, they have a different meaning, but that Greek word had that flexibility. And so he works off of that. That he was bringing in a new covenant. This agreement, you know, or, you know, it's not necessarily an agreement like we think of where, okay, I'll give this, no, and we argue about it. God made this covenant relationship. But it's also a will, a testament that comes into play when Jesus died and shed his blood. One point before we come to that, I want to come back to that in a moment. But I want you to look at number, which is number 1C, and it's based off chapter 8 and verse 13, where the writer says, in that he says, a new covenant, he has made the first obsolete. Now, what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. The last sentence of that, I just want to make a quick point here. Those who are sometimes called realized eschatologists, or some people say AD 70 advocates, though that can be a little confusing because I believe there was an AD 70, you know, but they believe that all Bible prophecy ended in AD 70. That was the second coming of Jesus. That was the final resurrection. And what they teach is from the time of Jesus to AD 70, there was this transition. The old covenant was fading away. It was still, it was in force, but it was fading. And they will turn here and say, see, it was becoming obsolete and ready to vanish, but it hadn't vanished. And they're totally missing what the Hebrew writer is saying. The Hebrew writer is saying, 600 years ago, Jeremiah said, this covenant is obsolete because I'm making a new one. From the time Jeremiah said it, it was, the writer is saying, for all practical purposes, it was then that it was becoming obsolete, growing old, ready to vanish away. The Hebrew writer makes it clear, the new covenant came in by means of his death. What does he say in chapter 10? In order to establish the second covenant, what did he have to do with the first? That's letter D, 1D. He had to take it away. Look at chapter 10, verse 9. I have come to do your will, O God. He takes away the first that he may establish the second. What does Galatians 3, 24, 25 say? When faith has come, we're no longer under the schoolmaster, the tutor, which he said is the law. There is no overlapping where you're part, you know, they're partly under the law. I have no doubt, but that what most Jewish Christians continued, we might say, to keep kosher. They didn't start eating pork. They didn't quit circumcising their children. But there were not two covenants in place. When Jesus came and died, he brought about the new covenant. The old was done away. And I point out under 1E, I think this has, you know, when somebody wants to justify instrumental music because of temple worship, That's there's just no way to do that. If you're going to justify instrumental music, you justify it under the new covenant, not under the old. And, you know, I mentioned a thief on the cross. You know, most popular criminal that's ever lived, I guess. You know, that, you know, people say, well, I'm going to be saved like a thief on the cross. And you know, you want to ask, well, do you mean you want us to nail you to a cross? You know, and then as your breath is going out of you, hope that you hear Jesus say, today you'll be with me in paradise? That, they don't mean that. They just mean, I'm going to say, you know, Jesus saved me. You know, not going to be baptized. I got a question, first of all. Was the thief ever baptized? We don't know, do we? We don't know that he wasn't. We don't know that he was. But it's kind of interesting what Mark 1 verse 5, I believe it's verse 5, says all Judea went out to him to be baptized. An awful lot of people have been baptized. But that's irrelevant except to say, I do want to say, sometimes you can sort of put somebody, kind of get them, their eyes opened a little bit when they're, you know, I want to do this. I don't believe you have to be baptized. The thief wasn't. And you just say, how do you know? And you show them where great multitudes, and he even calls it all Judea. That's, in my mind, if you do it in the right way, and you don't do it in any kind of a smart aleck way, you kind of maybe crack a door open there. You know, because they've never thought about that. And then you make the real point. Look at verse 17 of chapter 9, Hebrews 9. A testament is in force after men are dead. Galatians 4:4, Jesus was born under the law. When he was 40 days old, his parents had to go and they had to offer the sacrifices that you offered when a woman's days of purification were up. You know, that was part of the law. He lived under the law. After his death, we have a new law. And when Jesus was raised from the dead, he didn't tell the apostles, go into all the world and tell people if they will pray a prayer, if they will accept me as Savior. He said, you go preach. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. You know, go through Acts 2. But anyway, questions about the Sabbath. You know, if you don't want to eat the forbidden foods of Leviticus 11, you're welcome not to eat those. In fact, I wish fewer people would eat shrimp. It's that law of supply and demand. Y'all quit eating them, then the price can drop and I can afford more. You know, nobody has to eat any of those forbidden foods. But don't tell me that's God's diet. You know, I've seen books about, you know, we're going to get back, we're going to discover God's meal plan, basically. God doesn't have a meal plan. You know, that's not, get away from that. Let's live by the new covenant. And what does he say in 1 Timothy 4 under the new covenant about foods? That's right. That's right. If you can be thankful for it, you know, I think back on my childhood, I probably sinned a few times in eating some of that food because I wasn't thankful. Not for that broccoli. Oof. You know, and I like it now, but, you know, there's no be thankful and eat. Anybody have a question, comment before we? This is the jump around lesson tonight. You know, the what more shall I say? Look at chapter 10, verse 24. You know, let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. Remember the context. We talked about this a little in the previous lesson. Verse 19, having boldness, confidence to enter the holiest, drawing near to God, verse 22, holding fast the confession of your faith. Now he says, exhorting one another, stirring up love and good works. How do our assemblies accomplish something like that? What are some things that are done that do that? All right. What does he say in Colossians 3:16? You teach and admonish one another. Singing has great power to. As we're singing praises to God, we're also stirring one another up. Anything else? We study together, we challenge each other, we learn. Great strength to be drawn from that. Prayer. What about that? What's the old saying? There is strength in what? In numbers. You know, when you're in this battle and you're being besieged daily by, you know, various forces of evil, discouragements, people challenging your faith, questioning you, and you take a respite from that, and you come together with others who believe as you do, who serve the same God you do, that alone is able to stir you up. You know, to, you know, coming together, eating the Lord's Supper. What do you exhort them to do in Romans 16:16? Greeting one another with a holy kiss, or a hearty handshake, or a, you know, a, you know, but the greeting of one another, the camaraderie of brotherhood, these are things that make us, and hopefully we realize our need to do this, and we see brothers and sisters who've having a hard time, going through some difficulty in their life. And as we come together, we deliberately seek them out to offer words of encouragement, of admonition. You know, sometimes we have to correct one another. But that's the way we're stirred up to good works. Is if I'm doing bad works, somebody rebukes me for it. You know, being stirred up, it's not always just about a pat on the back. You know, sometimes, you know, when we're parents, we pat our children on the back, and sometimes we reach lower. You know, we need that as brothers and sisters. That we, 1 Corinthians 5, that discipline was administered when the whole church was gathered together. You know, stir one another up. Work on one another. Under B, I've got some other things. Worship, instruction, remembering Jesus, discipline, pooling our resources. I want you to look at number 2C. I said list at least three things. I have more than that. But some things you can do that'll help you get more out of the assemblies. Let's just imagine for a moment somebody, a brand new convert, somebody's never been accustomed to worshiping God in a congregational setting, says, what do I need to do to get the most out of this? What are some things you would tell them? Participate. In what ways? Yeah. Pray, listen, sing. Sing, you know, join into the singing. That, I think that's excellent. Anybody else? Pay close attention. If you're easily distracted, a notebook is a helpful thing. You know, Janet says the only reason I preach is because I can't sit still for somebody else to preach, you know. And there's more than a smidgen of truth. You know, no, I can be distracted. So I had a notebook and a pencil and I took notes. And, you know, I've got notes of sermons going back, you know, into my teen years. Because that I needed it. To be focused, to stay in it. And it helped me. Anybody else? Any thoughts? James. All right. I think being as rested as possible. I mean, there are going to be exceptions, but when we can't, try to get the proper rest. Try to be thinking about it. And you're talking about mental preparation. What do we expect to get out of it? You know, you go into something with a negative attitude, it's harder. You know, maybe about halfway through it, you finally go, oh, it's not as bad as I thought it was, but you've let half of it go by. On the other hand, you come in expecting good. Maybe, you know, maybe you'll find something. You know, and, you know, that's, I think those are some things. Exactly. I have sometimes talked about edification. That's one of the most misunderstood words today. Edification has been transformed in the minds of a lot of people into an emotional high. It's a feeling. Edification means being built up, made better. To go back to the illustration of my childhood, there were times that I was made into a better person by some very painful events in my life. You know, that they were not pleasant. Chapter 12 of Hebrews, they weren't pleasant for the moment. They resulted in being a better person. You know, do you come expecting to praise God, to learn, to be admonished, to possibly be corrected? Or do you expect to have a good time? You know, and what's amazing to me is when you quit worrying about having a good time and feeling good, that's when you tend to end up coming away feeling the best. When you forget yourself, it's no longer about you, it's about praising God, edifying others, you'll end up getting the most satisfaction out of it. Here's one nobody's mentioned yet. One of the best ways to get things out of the assembly is to be in the assembly. And I mean, don't stay home, don't be somewhere else, but also be in here as much as you can. You know, our Sunday morning, you know, is the longest period we're in one place, an hour and 15, hour and 20. You know, sometimes if Isaac goes too long, it's an hour and 25. But very few of us, if we go to the bathroom before, very few of our children should not be able to stay through a whole service, through a whole time. It's just not that long. You know, let's work on that. We got a whole bunch of questions, and I'm not going to get to all of them. But to contribute more to the edification of others, sing out, pay attention. When you're paying attention, it encourages others to pay attention. Make a deliberate effort. Think about others. Speak to others. You know, do all these things. Ron. Oh, no, I think that, that's worth coming back to. That's what I was saying. And Kevin was trying to get it. When we say, what are we getting out of it? Expect to get the right thing. Expect to become a better person because you're doing what God told you to do. Not because, you know, praising God molds us to be more what we ought to be. That's one of the great problems is that people are looking at worship like it's an entertainment. I mean, you see in the religious world around us, it's flashing lights. It's all manner of things. Except getting a focus that's vertical. You know, it's not even horizontal. It's just me. And that's wrong. That's exactly. Good point. Anybody else? Okay, Sheila. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, when you withdraw, there has to be something to withdraw. And we're withdrawing that association, and that's a good point. That's very valid. We need to develop that. Those ties. All right, I want us to look at number four. I'm going to skip to it because I think this is one that we can struggle with. I don't have a question on verses 1 and 2, but I want to set this before you. He has led us through those great characters of faith. Then he says, therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. He said, look, and the cloud of witnesses is likely having reference to these men and women of old. He said, you put off the weight. It's time. If there is something in your life holding you back, Get rid of it. And he said, look down the road. This race is unique in that I'm not racing against anyone else. I'm really just racing against myself and the desire to quit. And he said, you just run with endurance. You look out there and you see Jesus. Yeah, these witnesses are, in essence, cheering you on. But your focus, you see Jesus. He finished. He, despising the shame, in a sense, disregarding it, I think, is probably the idea. Not that he was, I despise that. Oh, that's terrible. No, that he just disregarded it. It was as nothing to him because he saw the end. And we've got to see that. We've got to run that race. And he says, I know what one of the difficulties for you is. These are tough times. Look at Jesus again. He endured hostility from sinners against himself. Verse 3. He said, I don't want you to become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted the bloodshed. You know, it's not gotten as bad as it could be. Look at Jesus. His was worse than yours. Then he says, look, the Lord chastens those he loves. Maybe I'm wrong, but it looks to me as if he's saying here, God's not the instigator of this hostility from sinners. But God could have intervened at any moment. There are times that God did. There are times like in Acts 12 when he delivered Peter from prison. When he smote Herod with worms and he died. But he says, God's not going to keep anything from you that could make you better. And we need difficulties. You know, over in James, he talked about how our trials, the testing of our faith, works patience. Verse 3 of the first chapter. That we must then let that have its complete work in us. To order to be complete, we've got to be refined. Romans 5 has the same concept. That I want God to take these problems away. And it may well be that my Father is saying to me, John, you have an independent streak about you. You don't tend to really put your faith in me. You know, you serve me, but you don't trust me for your everything. You'll learn it as you go through this trial. I'm not saying, I don't mean to suggest that I'm hearing a voice. You will hear a voice. But I do believe what Hebrews 12 is saying is that whatever God allows to happen in your life, He has your best in mind. He could stop this. He could intervene. It's not a sign that He's abandoned you. That's the key. The 13th chapter, He will say, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And that's the point, I believe, of this 12th chapter, is I've not abandoned you. You're enduring hostility from sinners against yourself like Jesus did. Don't become weary and discouraged. I've not abandoned you. In fact, I'm actually working on you. I'm making you a better person. I believe God chastens in other ways. I think He chastens us directly through His Word. I mean, that Word that pierces, you know, to the soul and marrow, or the soul and spirit. You know, I believe He chastens through our brethren. That's part of their job, to correct us. But the key thing, He hasn't abandoned us. Don't ever think that for a moment. Don't ever believe that. Anybody have a thought or comment on that? A lot I can't explain about it. But I believe the assurance that God's working for the best in my life. And he will not leave me or forsake me. Look at the 13th chapter, just a few of the random thoughts here. They're not random in the writer's mind. I'm saying I'm kind of randomly picking out some. Verse 7, and this is number 6, the New King James translates this, "Remember those who rule over you, who have spoken the word of God to you, whose faith follow, considering the outcome of their conduct." Now you might notice that it's got like a present tense, they're ruling over you, and yet outcome seems to be past tense. The New American Standard puts "those who led you," past tense. And the English Standard does it in a similar way. And I think probably what he's got is he's telling them, in a sense, look back to the beginning. These are people, again, his point is run the race with endurance. He says, you look back to those men who first brought the word to you. Look how their lives turned out. These men who trusted God to the end. Imitate them. And I think about this in two points I think about relevant to me. I didn't hear the word originally from apostles. But there have been some tremendous influences in my life. And I know you can say the same thing. So some of them would be shared influences, and then many of them be different. But people you've admired and appreciated that ran the race with endurance. And be inspired by them. Be encouraged by them. Remember the hope in which they died. But the second thing is I think about a few years from now, somebody looking back at my life. Will they look back at my life and say, now there is an inspiration. There was a man who never wavered. Or if, he made mistakes, but when he made a mistake, he was willing to admit it and pick himself up and go, and he didn't fall to the wayside. That's what I want to be. That's what we want to be. You know, we want to be people. You know, back in chapter 12, verse 12, I love this. He said, strengthen the hands that hang down, the feeble knees. Make straight paths for your feet. You know, get over this weariness and discouragement and run the race. Think about that. Quickly, chapter 13, verses 10 through 14. Again, there's more of that. We've got something better. These are people probably being excluded in many cases from family, from close associations. He said, we have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals, this is verse 11, whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin, are burned outside the camp. Therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Therefore, let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. He said, we have an altar. One of the great things of Judaism, I think one of the attractions, at least while the temple still stood, were those festive gatherings. You know, except for the burnt offering, when the whole animal was burned, most time it was only the fat that was burned on the altar. If you were making an offering, you gave a portion of it to the priest, but then you cooked and you ate the animal. And these, the Passover and all, most of the others, all except the Day of Atonement, these were celebration days. He said, we've got an altar that's even better to eat from. And I think the Lord's Supper might be a part of that. I'm going to take away the word small. But it's really like John 6. It's we've got food to eat that's far better. We have a spiritual feast in Jesus. But here's what we have to do. And here's the challenge, verse 13. We've got to be willing to bear His reproach. You can't have the right to partake of the altar if you're determined to stay in the camp, to maintain the approval of all those old acquaintances, the old religion, you know, the mindset that's all around you. You've got to be willing to step out and come to Christ. You won't come alone. You'll have brothers and sisters with you. And that's why he said, don't quit assembling together. You need one another. But you're going to leave some things behind. You're going to bear His reproach. He did. And so that's the key to this. Are we willing to bear His reproach? Maybe through friendships, fellowships, you know, ever. Bear His reproach. Folks, I've grown to love this book, and I hope you have too, and I hope it helped. This has helped you appreciate better. Run the race with endurance.